Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for your listening discomfort and displeasure. Because if you're listening to the truth and you're really being entertained by it, and it's really fun and it's funny and all of that kind of stuff, then there's a chance that you might have missed the point on it. It's a release valve, okay? You know, if you're a truther and you've woken up and you go, oh God. This ruthless, criminal, sociopathic scumbaggery that control every single hierarchical structural institution on the planet, and they think I'm a slave. You know, when you come to that realization, after a few people have told you about certain things, as you do, you wonder, oh my God, how do I cope with all of this? And I found that the answer is to tell jokes that are almost as bad as the truth is. You know, the Vinnie Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than Vinny's jokes is the truth. You know, it sort of works like that. It rings true in and of itself, like an onomatopoeia, you know? Like an onomatotaxpayer. But there's a couple of things that are coming up in New Zealand, right? Protests about John Key, protests about medical cannabis not being legal, that kind of thing. And I've been discussing this topic endlessly online with my I've come to know them as colleagues, you know, activists and other people of such ilk, and it seems like it's like coming to a head, like we're getting some kind of accomplishment. And as soon as I feel like I'm accomplishing something, that's when I know that there's something wrong. Well, I mean, not to be too cynical about it, but I'm pretty cynical about it, you know. What you got to really think about is this, all right? How best to placate me into just kissing it off and doing nothing, you know, feeling relaxed about it. How best to do that for me? Well, I guess the best way to do it in a very carte blanche kind of fashion is to have widely publicized sources in the compromised alternative media tell you that everything's going all right and it's going okay. So I wanted to get people in the mood. In the sort of resistance mood, because I was in the mood this morning when I walked out trying to go get some food. I was in the mood while I was going to get food. That's an interesting coincidence and a rhyme right there. Anyway, I looked up and I freaked my wife out. I go, fuck, it's a giant chemtrail. And there was, bro. It was large as fucking life. It was stretched the whole way across from one horizon to the other. And I was just like, okay, dude, I got to get myself a time lapse over this. But unfortunately, or rather fortunately, depending on which way you look at it, the wind blew the chemtrail away, just gone. I decided, and I was like feeling really nervous about it. I don't know why I was feeling nervous. Maybe that just comes with the territory. Anyway, I decided that I would go out to my local shop area and protest. I had a stop chemtrails sign, a megaphone, and my little shoulder mount with a GoPro on it to shoot me from the front. And I just stood outside the shopping center on the other side of the road with the chemtrail in the background of the shop while I was holding the chemtrail sign from my and the megaphone. It was great. It was fun. Just there for about 25 minutes while I was picking up some groceries, bullhorning and holding up a protest banner at the pedestrian crossing. So that people stopped and thought that I was crossing, but they didn't. And instead, they got a chance to look at the banner a little bit more closely that said, "Stop chemtrails." One guy drove through the intersection and remarked on that very thing. And I go, it's kind of the point. Sorry that me protesting all of us getting sprayed like cockroaches with toxic chemicals is such a really hard issue for you. The chemtrail thing was quite interesting because as soon as I saw it, I was like, boom, you know, just onto my Facebook. Everybody, oh my God, get your cameras out and get some time-lapse footage of this puppy. And some people did. I'm not sure if some people didn't. But what was interesting about doing the protest is I was like, I had these two general assumptions about what would happen when I went out and did it. And I was proven correct, as I naturally do when I cynically assume things. And those two things were, somebody would ask me what the heck I was talking about and actually come up and talk to me, and then I'd have a really nice conversation, which I did. And the second one was that I'd probably get abused and or possibly physically attacked. And both happened. The latter happened from a cyclist of all things, Oh, fuck off, you know, as he rides past, you know, it was like a ride-by. He was like totally gangster, bro. It was classic. And he wasn't actually that gangster. No. Definitely not in the Snoop Dogg sense of the word anyway. Regardless, the other one, which I'm not 100% sure if it was deliberate. So finished protesting, we're going to like toss my stuff back in my car and then just go into the supermarket to pick up my breakfast. You know, as you do when you're a newsman, it's like, I got a job to do. And as I'm walking back to the car, I'm like walking behind the cars as they're pulling out. One of them starts reversing just as I get right behind it and doesn't stop, kind of thing. But luckily I had pretty quick reflexes, so I just like, whoa, jumped quickly out of the way just as soon as I felt the pressure on my thigh. You know, I was just like, there's a freaking car running into my leg. I'm not sure if that was deliberate, although it was a Mercedes with four exhausts and tinted windows. Don't know. But anyway, it was freaky, you know. What was it Penny Bright told me? Do one thing every day that scares you. What was interesting about this was how little recognition there was. It's actually not all that surprising, not getting any toots or anything like that when you're just one guy with a chemtrail banner standing outside a supermarket in West Auckland. Okay, not overly surprising. However, the fact that there was almost zero recognition for the issue perplexed me somewhat. Just kind of wanted to take a little bit of a sample. I sort of assumed that that might happen as well. It's really strange. We've got Ben Vidgen coming up on the line. He's a New Zealand journalist. G'day, bro. How are you going?
Good, good, mate. I'm an indirect victim of the Panama Investment Canal crisis.
The Panama Investment Canal crisis. It sounds rectal.
Yeah, man, it's all these people that have these hyperinflated properties in Queenstown that can't afford to live there, so they're all working like madmen, so they won't pick you up on the road because they're all busy rushing off to work. Yeah. So I literally got into the studio about 2 minutes just beforehand.
Okay, well, that's good. It only gave me, like, a petite mal seizure.
Welcome to my world.
What is it with being a newsman? I was like, okay, I'm going to make this thing. I'm not going to talk about current affairs or do this kind of stuff. But even when you're not talking about current affairs, stuff appears really urgent for some reason. And you're stressing out and you're rushing all over the place to talk about stuff that happened years ago. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, why the sense of urgency?
I know. I mean, I'm sitting on the roadside. Actually, to be honest, I'm not feeling that way because I'm sitting on the roadside this morning, like watching row after car driving past me, getting all panicky, and I sit there and I'm looking at this amazing mountain scenery, this amazing area, and a little sea of gold, and I just went, oh yeah, it'll happen, and it did, just, you know, connected in, but it was touch and go, I'll give you that.
I also fantasize occasionally about sitting in traffic on the way to a job, and then I snap out of it.
So how are we going? How's this going to roll today?
That depends how much marijuana you've got. But I was starting off with the topic of geoengineering, which is not one of your topics. So we can go on to your book. Have you finished your book, bro?
I have actually finished my book.
Awesome.
I've done the limited edition. So we're just doing a very small print run to begin with, which just gives me a chance to kind of spot a few little quirky bits. And then we'll do another print edition and then we'll see whether the publishing companies pick it up or not. But if they don't, that's okay. I'm getting to go travel all around New Zealand and catch up with the people, the amazing people I got to deal with 2014, show them what I've done and develop my website. And at the same time, we're going to be using it to launch a magazine New Zealand wide and hopefully the beginning, end of this year, maybe next year. But that's the usual situation. It's a song and a prayer and you're not dealing with a mainstream media budget. So we get there.
What's so interesting about the mainstream media budget is it only buys you really good looking crap.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, and again, it's, you know, we look at this whole way that this Panama investment situation has occurred is that there's a ton of material that's actually been leaked out, same with WikiLeaks, and they could very easily be making this the main story and dealing into it, but they're really kind of just commenting on what the overseas media is saying and then asking John what he's saying, and he's saying the same thing that he said in 2010 when SP Trading Limited was New Zealand nominee firm was found linked to a shipment of arms in Korea, a big Antonov aircraft, something that I've been writing about for 15 years, and he went, oh, John's looking into it, we don't need to do any further investigational work. But, you know, as we know from the track record, not only in this case, but as in with SP Trading Investments in 2010, looking into it never actually goes anywhere. And this is, again, a repeat of what we learned during the Winebox inquiry during the 1990s, that, again, they pick their hand-picked crew of people that are trained in the art of not investigating. And this is pretty much what we've seen as a repeat of the same cycle going over and over again. I've just finished writing a book called Ben's New Zealand, and I'm traveling all around New Zealand. So if you're interested in other things I have to say, just check out my Facebook page, which is Ben Vidgen, Bravo. Cabo Eco November, Victor India Delta Golf Eco November. I'll be putting up different posts and little podcasts around New Zealand. Some of it's touristy, but it all sort of has a bit of a deeper layer than most of the candy floss out there. The reason why I kind of asked Vinny to be on the show was that in 1999, I wrote a book called State Secrets, published by Howling at the Moon. We sold nearly 15,000 copies. It was on the bestsellers list for 6 months, and it didn't get one single mainstream media review. And this came off the back of what we called the Wine Box Inquiry, which was one of our MPs, Winston Peters, was suggesting that New Zealand was at the center of what we're now seeing with Panama Investments. And what everyone was saying was that this was definitely linked to some sort of money laundering, but no one really knew what the money laundering was. And this was, again, nothing new, because you can go all the way back to the 1970s when New Zealand had another little episode called The Gang of 20, involving a guy called John Victor Evans. In my book, I actually interviewed Keith Peterson, who was the chief investigator for the Justice Department at the stage. And Peterson was saying the same situation. We knew this money laundering was going on, but we didn't know what actually for. Well, I came back to New Zealand just after the Wine Box Inquiry. I'd been working in Australia for the banking sector, which has got a little part of the story, and I'd also been working for 2UE, my first and last job with the mainstream media. And when I read a book which was put out by my publisher, a guy that I have a lot of differences with him today, but at the end of the day, Ian Wishart is a man who was ahead of the field of everybody else, what they were saying. And I read his book, and there was a line in there talking about rumours of a deal that was going on between New Zealand and we were trading butter, which is, you know, New Zealand's a dairy country, for Middle Eastern oil, which was then in turn being exchanged for arms. And I looked at the story and I went, wait a minute, I've got a large chunks of the missing part. So State Secrets was, while everyone was dismissing this notion, I was saying, why are we dismissing this notion? I can show you company office files which have the names of MPs on it, people like Ross Morant, because that was one of the things that was being said, that the East Lawning was also being involved for, I won't use the word bribery, but agents of influence. So we had company office files with guys like Ross Morant, an MP who'd gone on about the dangers of gangs and activism, who was now a director of a Russian bank called Proc Bank, based in Vanuatu, which Customs, and that's, you know, when I came into the picture, because Customs came to me and said, well, you actually know more about this bank than we do. So I started working with Customs, and they opened their files and showed me that some of the guys involved in Proc Bank were some pretty heavy hitters, people like the Shumilyovs, which are actually what we call FSB, but back then was KGB.
And that's also where the saying having shamillions of dollars comes from.
Yeah, very much like a caught between a proc and a rock. So we had company files that were set up like that. And then we also had the other thing that came out of the Wine Box Inquiry was a lot of deals specifically revolving around the transactions for European Pacific based in the Cook Islands, which had customers which were linked for things like BCCI, the Bank of Commerce Credit International, which we now know is used as a laundering for engineering arms assassination and backroom arms deals and agents of influence again. And that also had a lot of talk about leasing front companies that were being used to buy these big, huge air companies that were being used to ship arms. And I was saying, well, again, why are we dismissing this? Just down the road, we've got companies like Pacific Express, which came out of Southern World Airlines. And Southern World Airlines, again, you had Paul McElwee, the lawyer for John Victor Evans, involved in the Gang of 20. You had Ozzie Malcolm, the Minister of Immigration. These were guys, people involved in this particular product. And then you had guys that went from this company into Pacific Express, because when Southern World Airlines got busted by TVNZ, Rod Vaughan, it fell over. Pacific Express actually popped up. You had the Serious Fraud Office when it fell over. They said when the guy that was running it, Simon Spitz, skipped the country in the late 90s, the head of the Serious Fraud Office turned around and said, oh, we knew that these guys were involved in arms dealing, but we didn't want to go after them because they were backed by CIA muscle and we didn't fancy our chances against that. And that's a direct quote from his own book, Dirty Collars. So again, you had the head of the Serious Fraud Office saying, yes, this sort of thing's going on. But in his own book, when talking about the Wine Box Inquiry, saying, oh, no, that had nothing to do with money laundering and arms deal. That was rumours. You go, well, why? And what became very interesting again was all of the stuff that they were talking about at that point was nearly 10 years ahead of what we then came to know as the Food for Oil scandal. For those who don't know, the Food for Oil scandal was a deal that was set up that basically Iraq was stopped from actually exporting countries unless they were doing it for humanitarian reasons. But the companies that were involved in it were then paying kickbacks to Iraq. And those firms in turn, money kickbacks, were being then used to buy Eastern European weapons. So you had literally, if you looked at what was going on in the Food for Oil deal, you had a three-way transaction between food or butter, guns and oil. Again, interesting enough, on Proc Bank, one of the guys that was the director of that was Ian Robertson, former head of the New Zealand Dairy Board, which we now know today as Fonterra. His website today, Vostok Exports, they say they specialize in New Zealand dairy products, Russian munitions, and Middle Eastern oil. So it's right there in your face. This company, Vostok Exports, they also had another subsidiary company called Vostok Immigration, and this was a company that was brought in by the New Zealand government operating out of many places, but one was the New Zealand consulate in Vietnam, and they will be using these Russian mafia guys to set up deals to actually facilitate so that the milk products that we were giving to Iraq were going through third shipment companies. To go back 5 years before that, we had what they call Powdergate, which was when Fonterra was actually caught repackaging products. So when they were saying they're going to Italy, they're actually going somewhere else. Again, everyone knew that this was involved for tax evasion, they knew it was for laundering, but no one could actually work out for what reason, except for that when you turn around and you looked at the United Nations primary documents and you looked at the 23 companies that I identified that were shipping New Zealand dairy products, so you had 23 companies on the actual UN documents that were actually shipping New Zealand goods. And the interesting thing about these guys was that 22 of them were subsidiaries of a company called HSA Yemen, who were one of the chief financiers for the bank Al-Taqwa in Lugano, Switzerland, also where the guy running Pacific Express had previously been based. And this was the chief bank that was used to finance the terrorist attacks in 9/11. So what you were seeing time and time again, where people saying, oh, no, this is not going on, but you could find hardcore empirical examples showing that this actually was the case.
And of course, just because there's evidence doesn't mean people are going to talk about it or believe it, right?
Well, they wouldn't even talk about it. But then again, you get into, you know, the key players. So like the chief accountant for Food for Oil was a guy called David Mace. David Mace was the senior partner for Ernst & Young Hong Kong. If you're that way inclined, he was also the leading Freemason in New Zealand. Now, this guy was brought in, handpicked by Andy Coffin, to run all the payouts, which were then being paid to these people that were doing kickbacks. Always worked out in a way that they got a favorable exchange. And when the KPMG looked at these guys, well, their investigation didn't go any further because their chief guy actually got blown up. The GEO turned around and said, well, we're not going to say this guy's dirty, but, you know, we've got to ask what the hell he was thinking about. You had all these international organizations saying, this is weird, what's going on? But yet again, that story got pushed way down by the mainstream media, specifically the US media, where their chief guys who were doing the monetary side of it for them was actually Ernst & Young. So they were, again, sending themselves to investigate. And again, during all these things I talk about with Fonterra and the wine box, they would keep on bringing in the Serious Fraud Office to investigate these issues. And, well, let me put it this way, the head of the Serious Fraud Office, which was when it was set up to replace the Justice Department, who were doing a great job, was a guy called Warwick Reed, who didn't actually get very far in the job because he got busted for being in pay of the triads. And a lot of the guys that were working with him should have been cleaned out of the Serious Fraud Office, yet they were still there when this was all going on. You'd find things like the Iraq B&L scandal. They used the same accounts for the Food for Oil scandal, which were then being paid into Hong Kong banks using the SCO system, which repeated itself in the Ron Winwell or the Murray Loans affair situation. So you know, it wasn't just that they were sending their own people to investigate, but they were even using the same bank accounts, and no one was actually feeling like they even had to change their systems. So the paper trail, to follow it back from historically, wasn't that bloody hard.
It's about being cynical and assuming things, I've found. If you're going to investigate things without really investigating them, it just pays to be cynical and assume. Well, so, for example, if you wanted to run some really serious fraud-style operations, who would be number one on your bribe list? The Serious Fraud Office.
Exactly, you know. And I mean, even during the Winebox Inquiry, you found there were direct relationships. In fact, on my Facebook page, I've got documentation from the Winebox Inquiry showing that direct link between the Serious Fraud Office and Fayrite Investments, who are the lead stars in that particular affair. But, you know, it went beyond that because later on during the whole Food for Oil situation, when we, and I'll tie this into the Panama very soon, but when we turned around and we got named in this document by, again, offshore media, Winston Peters, ironically, because everyone associates him as a crusader for the Winebox Inquiry, turned around then as the Minister of Foreign Affairs and said, nothing to see, no one's wrong here, move along. And then Transparency International came back and said, wait a minute, you haven't even investigated the primary documents, in other words, the documents at the source, not good enough. Do it again. So the mainstream media issued press releases saying that the Serious Fraud Office and the police were going to then turn around and actually carry out a probe, which they in media land did, and which the point Winston Peters turned around and said, see, told you, nothing to see, move along. The only small problem with that was that I actually went and interviewed all the companies, and there's some very interesting New Zealand companies involved, aside from Fonterra, and the response from all of those guys was that, you know, we haven't even had a phone call from the Serious Fraud Office. We haven't had a call from the police. When I contacted the Serious Fraud Office, they refused to answer my calls. The media spokesman for the police, which I think was Ian Church, don't quote me on that, but Ian Church actually turned around and he was a bit embarrassed about it. He went, yeah, actually, we haven't done anything. You know, the media spokespeople are normally quite tight-lipped, but they actually acknowledged that, no, they had not been given any instructions yet. And the press was saying that a probe had been conducted and nobody ever went back and actually confirmed to see whether it was actually done. They just took the press release at its word.
Yeah. This is why I've come to know the media, not as the press, but as the depress, because whenever I see them, it just makes me sad.
Well, yeah, and again, you know, when you turn around and you look at a lot of the people that are running the mainstream press, you'll discover that they're also involved in public relations companies that are, the phone crisis occurs, they call these guys to deal with it. So you've got this real conflict of interest going on as well. From the food for oil situation, again, you know, for 15 years, I wrote a second book, State Secrets, and then I had the photographs of these big Russian Antonovs landing in New Zealand. I had the company office showing you which companies, which buildings, companies like Southern Canterbury Finance, household companies.
And where can people buy your book?
Which one? State Secrets 1, which gives you all the hardcore. Just go to my website, www.postmanproductions.org. There's a sticker for my book on my front page, on my homepage. Click on it and it's set up as a PDF, so you don't have to pay a cent. I figure I did 15,000 copies. I got slightly, you know, less money than a Weet-Bix for my efforts. And I went, hey, but that's cool. It's free. Now anyone can read it and I don't care. It's in the public arena because that's the only way, if it gets read and disseminated, that what I was going to say is going to get out there. Because when I wrote State Secrets in 99, everyone was telling me, all the mainstream guys were saying, there is no such thing as organized crime in New Zealand. Now, you know, I don't know about you, Vinny, but if you looked at the newspapers today and you see the big drug bust going on with the headhunters and they're pulling out long-range sniper weapons and machine guns, and you've seen caseloads of machine guns being pulled out of Timaru, anyone to try and suggest that there's not organized crime now today would be laughed out of the room. But back then, oh, no, 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 no. The government's telling us that there's no organized crime and we're looking at the press release and we're not going to listen to what you're saying. We're not going to look at the documents. We're not going to give you an hour on television to debate your issue with our finest and bestest. We're just going to say, no, it's not happening. Alistair Thompson from Scoop Media, who's probably one of the better alternative media, and they kind of walk a tight line between them and mainstream, he said it best when he said howling at the tube, and he put out the one article we got saying, why is there a media blackout on State Secrets? State Secrets 2 I published in 2006. And really, the only way you can kind of get that is from asking for it. And I'm down to my last 30 copies. One man, many, many jobs to be done. But those are the two books. If you're interested in the whole kind of money laundering and arms dealing thing that I was being told repeatedly, and everyone was saying, good, great joke about Ben Vigen and Aaron Hawkins, the counselor for the DCC, who's going, oh, Ben Vigen and his conspiracy theories about white collar and tax evasion and arms dealing, ho, 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 ho. And then they looked a bit stupid in 2010 when finally it hit the mainstream newspapers. But again, they only hit the surface. They looked at the nominee directorships that were the core issue behind that particular event. They went no further. And yet, to give you an idea of the scale that we're talking about, because this is really the core issue. I mean, arms dealing, money laundering, it sounds very exotic and sensational, but it's not really the core issue what's going on. The two core issues is, number one, I say the reason why you can't get a decent cup of coffee in Auckland is because of organized crime. And everyone goes, what? How do you work that one out? And so, well, let me walk you through this. Back in the days, in the mid-90s, there was a company called EIE Limited.
They were owned by old McDonald, allegedly.
It's Japanese partners, actually. Oyo, to be precise, the Yakuza. And when they actually fell over, it turned out the whole thing was a front organization for the Yakuza. Now, the key thing was EIE, at that stage, owned 90% of the downtown real estate of Brisbane and Auckland. And what they were then doing was buying property prices, which they would then sell back to themselves through this very extensive paper trail, which was all tied up in blind trusts and tax havens, which would then in turn inflate everywhere else the property prices. So the end result was that everybody in downtown Auckland was paying exorbitant rents. So if you had a little cafe in Auckland, like it was costing you an arm and leg to run it, so instead of using fresh milk every time you went to make a cup of coffee, you'd use the same jug with whatever was milk, even though it was scaldy burnt two or three times, make that the coffee, give that to the customer, and the customer was going away with a bad cup of coffee, care of the Yakuza. Huh? So if you follow my logic, it's the trickle-down effect in reverse. And of course, the second thing is what we're seeing here is a transfer of wealth. And this is nothing new again. Like at the beginning of the Renaissance period, there were over 1,200 merchant banks in Europe alone. When I worked for Westpac in Sydney, there are six large volumes they have in the office there, which show you every single bank in existence. When you actually start to look through them, you actually realize there are actually only six actual major banks. And if I can remember off the top of my head, because it was a long time ago, it was Citibank, which we'll come back to in a second. It was Mitsubishi Tobacco, Tokyo Bank. It was Deutsche Bank, Chem Bank, and the New York First, which I can't remember because that bank changes its name every time I look around. And then there was one other. There were six predominant banks, and all these processes that these were looking at, what that actually allows them to be looking at is a consolidation of wealth. And the end result is, when I left school in the 1980s, you were looking at 90% of the wealth was in the 10% of the world's population. When I left university at the end of the 90s, that was 95% of the world's resource was in the hands of 5% of the population. Now, today, we're following the global financial downturn, whatever you want to call it, we're now acknowledging our mainstream media, which shows you how bad it's got, is acknowledging that 99% of the wealth is now in the hands of 1%. And it's all through this whole process of not having to pay taxes and being able to launder this money through so that you're able to create a situation where you can control and engineer markets and collapse them as you will. And that's really the core issue behind these investment bankers.
I hate to be technical, but we had Bill Blank, the financial researcher on the show the other
day. Amazing guy, yeah.
And he says it's not like 1% versus 99%. It's more like 0.00001% versus the 99.99999%. That's where the wealth is actually distributed. There's not more than really a handful of people that control virtually all the wealth.
And that's pretty much on the button as well. I mean, as I said, our mainstream media reports it's 99%, and we know how accurate and up with the speed they are. So Chris Black, who I believe is the only guy to actually have put 1,000 bankers in jail.
Bill Black, sorry.
But yeah. I remember seeing a thing on him in about 2014, actually. It was on RT television. Bill has this amazing record behind him, and yet he can't get coverage in his own country, despite his pedigree. And he says it very accurately. It's not until we start actually putting bankers in jail, or as I like to call them, banksters, that we're going to see anything changing. But unfortunately, we're not, because look at New Zealand. Our Prime Minister, as is the case for the last 15 years, is a banker. Most of the predominant people in the front bench of his cabinet have got banking connections. Simon Powers, he brought in a guy that was sent to oversees the tender process for the banks that basically gave the banks a rubber stamp and said, oh, no, it's all legitimate. But no one in turn around said it was specifically Westpac. And at that time, one of the directors of Westpac was Simon Bridges, who was, again, part of that national
Simon Power. Simon Bridges Powers is the other one.
Yeah, the other.
He was the former Justice Simon. Minister. And I believe during the time of the crisis with South Canterbury Finance, Westpac Bank became one of the primary beneficiaries of the receivership of its assets. Later on, after the receivership was done, where it said, oh, it was a big Ponzi scheme, they managed to return 98% of investors' money, right? Yeah. And guess who got a job as head of corporate banking for Westpac? The guy who signed off the statutory management by the Serious Fraud Office, Simon Powers, the former Justice Minister.
Jobs for the boys. And this is what we're seeing time and time again. And if you're looking at all the key panel appointments and all the positions at John Key, the flag panel, the constitutional review panel, John is constantly putting his own people into these positions with a track record. It's a serious, obvious conflict of interest, but yet nobody in our media, because of course he's put his own people in the media, are actually challenging them.
He's not just put his own people in the media. He's actually ousted the people who aren't on his side.
Yeah. Entirely. And in fact, I'm trying to think, it was Catherine Gates, who's one of my friends on my Facebook. She did a really good piece showing all the the good journalists, the people that were doing their jobs and, award-winning, had created programs that were rating, getting the ratings. And there's a very long list of people that have been knocked off their perches and fired for doing their jobs.
It was around the region of 9 really, really credible New Zealand journalists have lost their jobs since John Key came into power in 2008, now 2016, something around that area. And it was just quite obvious to me when John Campbell's show got threatened with being cut off by Mark Weldon, the head of TV3, who's a personal friend of John Key. And yep. John Campbell had been recently very critical of John Key on his show and embarrassed him quite a lot. And despite the fact that his ratings started to boom as soon as people thought that he was getting cancelled, they still cancelled him anyway.
I know. And the same situation you had on that was the other one, partner in crime there, was Julie Christie, who's a very good friend of Gerry Brandley, the Minister of Eating Pies, Fat Gerry, and, very good friend of us, and she gets appointed to the flag panel, and along with Weldon, they get appointed to these other little kind of, panels which are meant to tell us about what the New Zealand people think, but actually just turn around and tell us what John Key's elite mates are thinking. I'm down here in the bottom of South Island, a very rural part of the environment. People generally don't think a lot of this bigger issue. They're just getting on with life, very lovely people. And I'm running around, doing my little road travel thing at the moment, and I'm talking to farmers and people that are going, they're getting it. And this is something that these are very conservative people that will traditionally vote National, and they're saying, I am not going to vote John Key this time because this corruption is, even we get it now that this is just wrong.
But what's problematic is that this game keeps being played. It gets played on the Americans. It gets played on us, that as if there's some kind of difference between Labour and National, whereas if you... I don't know what their finances are like, but I assume that it must be exactly like the US, where you have a whole lot of backers who back both sides so that they hedge their bets. That way they'll get favourable legislation regardless of who's in there.
Well, you're completely correct, and you know, and I'll come to New Zealand in a second, but it did remind me of another thing. Was when I published State Secrets in 99, the day that I flew into Auckland to do my book release, there was a plane on the tarmac. This was at the time of the APEC conference when they were putting forward these, you know, free trade agreements, and there was an Indonesian plane on the tarmac, and that got my interest, and I started to look around and discovered that there was a guy in New Zealand as part of the APEC conferences, a guy called James Riady, who was the head of Lippo Group Indonesia, but also was one of the key players in the BCCI banking scandal. And, you know, we got to end up getting a hold of a picture of him shaking hands with Bill Clinton. Now, at the time, James Riady was a fugitive from the American justice. He was wanted for 123 illegal finance contributions to the Clinton administration's government. And he was also recognized as an asset of Chinese military intelligence. Again, I'll come back to that again. The interesting thing is, a lot of the guys that were the players involved in that particular drama, when Obama came into the equation, these were the same people. Even though Obama and Hillary were at the time, you know, hammer and tongs, oh, no, we're better than each other and so on, they were actually getting their funding from the same direct paper trail. And it's these, you know, they're tied up with China, but it's more than that. It goes bastards beyond borders, you know. But it's bringing that China point, you know, again, it's, you know, another example we've got here of how the whole process works and the bigger game going on is that, one of the guys that's identified from the New Zealand end, and again, I'm going to step back because this is quite interesting. This is credit for journalism, you know, showing you that sometimes it does actually work. The Consortium of International Investigative Journalism, they were the ones that broke the story, and they, first of all, leaked that story. They used US media, and I suspect it was guys tied up with the guy that with Edward Snowden. They turned around and they tied up with those guys. They turned around and said, you know, New Zealand's named in these papers. And they set up this beautiful ambush because that night John Key came on television and said, oh, no, New Zealand's not a tax haven. It'll only be a minor, maybe one or two. It's not that big a deal. The next day, the Consortium of Investigative International Journalists dropped their bombshell. They went, actually, we're named 60,000 times in these documents, which then made John go, oh, well, actually, maybe we need to have a review, and I'll pick my pet poodle to investigate the review, which, because he'd already been set up the first time by these very, very clever guys, even our own mainstream guys were going, yeah, right, John. And so I'd love to see what else they've got for us, because I think these are very, very – there's 300 of these guys, and they're clever. And so I think they've got a few more surprises up their sleeves. But they – in these papers, they named – they gave a company, again, I went through and I took the trouble to look for all the nominee directors and start to get some patterns forming. And from one of these guys I actually identified was a guy called, it's on my Facebook page, but I think it's Lee Chang. Now, Lee Chang, aside from being a very wealthy guy with lots of connections to the same people that John Key is actually meeting at the moment as we speak, he had bought up over 80 companies in New Zealand. Two of them alone are worth a net value of about $1 million. So that's, you know, that shows you a lot of money. But Lee Chang is also a director of Hutchison Whampoa, which is the big Chinese consortium company that basically is in the habit of buying ports. So the aim of the game is to buy strategic assets that undermine the national sovereignty of those countries. And this is, again, something that our government has done, worked in conjunction with guys like Fay Richwhite. They've been consecutively using these investment banks to bring in these overseas companies to then privatize key strategic assets, which then take away our ability to decide to be masters and commanders of our own ships. And it's a much, you know, it's a big chess game we're dealing with.
Is Fay Richwhite involving Michael Fay there?
Fay Richwhite Investments is Michael Fay and David Richwhite. And again, it's interesting because these guys, and when I did State Secrets, they were, you know, star witnesses of the Winebox Inquiry. And we mentioned them in my book in terms of meeting with a guy called Thomas Weiner, who's a major cocaine trafficker operating out of Tonga. And we sent a fax to those guys saying, well, you know, what's your connection to this major cocaine dealer? and got no reply. But the day before my book actually got published, we got this phone call. The publisher got a phone book saying, you know, if the Winer book comes out, you're all dead. And which was really funny, because at that stage, there were only three parties that actually knew that Winer was in the book, which was me, my publisher, and Fay Rich White Investments. So, you know, I'm not saying anything, but draw your own conclusions on that one.
All right. They've got the name Rich White, okay?
Yeah, isn't it? You know, I mean, run with that one.
You know, I'm not going to say anything more. It tells you everything you need to know.
There were some rich white guys.
Make a company that's exclusively looks after the riches of white guys. What do we call it? You can't make this shit up. Oh, my God. Hey,
but it's not just rich white guys, because, again, we're talking about the usual suspects. So if we – and his name hasn't popped up yet in the Panama Investment. But let's reverse engineer this. There's a very famous guy called Adnan Khashoggi. He's the chief key spokesperson for the Saudi government. So when they want to deal with the West, Khashoggi was the guy that turned around and said. Now, he started turning up in New Zealand in the 1970s, about the same time that New Zealand started to realize that they had massive oil reserves. And – he was involved in basically doing – he made a deal. He said to the government, you know, we will open our doors to foreign investment in the Middle East in exchange for the fact that you must keep your oil in the ground and likewise open your doors, because New Zealand at that stage was very hard for offshore companies to buy into us, to us. So that's the first time that Khashoggi turned up. And within 3 years, we've gone from exporting 23 million, give or take, to the Middle East to we're exporting 400 million to just to Iran alone. Same time – Khashoggi starts to turn up in Vanuatu. It starts to use it as a tax haven to launder arms. He's tied up with the destabilization of the Santos government in the 1980s. And then Khashoggi then turns up. He's the guy that his company, Quintex, which is again tied up with the whole Iran-Contra, Oliver North and Ronald Reagan, all those, you know, clowns. Same company was used to ship weapons to the first coup in Fiji in 1987. That was based in Scenic Circle, in Travelodge, which then became Scenic Circle, whose current owner, Earl Hagerman, is one of the guys that's been mentioned in the Panama tax investment companies. So he set up, turns up as a financier for the first coup in the Fiji. Then we turn around and discover that when they have the issues in Bougainville, where the guys were saying, well, they wanted to kick out the copper mines, which were one of Khashoggi's buddies, lo and behold, it's Tim Spicer, who is the ex-SAS guy, flying in troops into Bougainville on these big Antonovs, who turns out to actually have a very close working relationship with Simon Spitz, the guy that's got Pacific Express based in Auckland. These guys get busted trying to carry out a coup. So then you turn around, you find at the same time, a little bit earlier than that, you find that Philippines, Khashoggi then turns up again, and he's actually, this time, he's laundering the gold into Fiji and the Cook Islands, which is, as I said beforehand, it's one of the companies that turned up during the Winebox inquiry. So, you know, you start to see the same names again and again. And when you say, oh, everyone goes, oh, this is a surprise, you're going, why is this a surprise? The systems that he's utilizing are the same systems he used in 1970. And in fact, in many of the cases, he's even using the same bankers. And like, for example, I'll give you another example. When they did the food for oil, one of the companies involved in that was called New Zealand Waste Management or New Zealand Waste Technology. The chief director of that was David Appleby, who was the accountant for Bishop Ron Renwald, who were the core of the Murray Loans affair, which turned out that they were launching another big, huge tax haven and money laundering scheme out of the Cook Islands to launder arms deals and also to use to buy politicians. So this is the same plin plate, the same players that we're seeing over and over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's otherwise known as Khashoggi workmanship.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, very Khashoggi. I love your puns. It's just not funny, Vinny.
If you say so. You know, because when you're paying for your cuppa in Auckland, you could be paying the Yakuza.
Yeah, pretty much. Or, you know, that's just very Khashoggi, you know.
Yeah, Khashoggi workmanship. Yeah. God damn, that's actually just
Khashoggi workmanship.
It's a Khashoggi joke.
That's certainly not punny. Anyway, enough of this bad humour.
Wait. Actually, before we do, I got one more joke to squeeze in here. All right, because remember when the back in the day, there was a huge farming family called the Crafers, and their farms were like on sale because they were like
involving Fay Rich White Investments as well.
Exactly, and a listener called me up at the time on the show, and they go, "Hey, Vinny, how expensive is New Zealand farmland?" And I go, "Well, let me put it like this. The only two people who can afford it are James Cameron and huge Chinese conglomerates that are being sold through Michael Fay, which is otherwise known as a Fay Dunaway.
Yeah. You could say, because they could also say that's a weave it off the rails if you take into account their involvement in Transrail and privatisation of that. Which, interestingly enough, again, I'll just mention it very briefly. The privatisation of rail in New Zealand was actually, the architecture of that was a guy called Stephen Jennings, who worked very closely with John Key before he went up and set up a bank in Russia called Renaissance Bank. And what Renaissance Bank did was they went into Moscow, and at that time, the perestroika, and they were giving people shares for these, you know, now owned by the people companies, and people were broke. They had no money. So when this guy turned around and gave them a bottle of vodka and $100, Jennings was able to then turn around and buy these, you know, $100 million factories for a tenth of their price. Now, Jennings was actually the same guy that actually then went on to finance John Key into being the Prime Minister of New Zealand the first time round. And at the same time, you know, it was his plan which allowed Fay Richwhite to actually privatise New Zealand Rail, which was sold off a scrap, and then we had to turn around and buy it back. So again, it's off the rails. It's very Khashoggi workmanship.
Kind of like cocaine drug lord workmanship, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It blows.
Yeah. And they are fond of rails as well. Now, I want to get into Ben's NZ, this new book that you're coming out, because this is actually the whole point of the show, and we're coming down to it. We've only got like 2 minutes left.
Ah, yeah. Ben's NZ. Okay, Ben's NZ is a slightly different approach. It boils down to that, largely because I've been reporting on the stuff which we're only now just starting to acknowledge for 20 years and been told that it didn't exist and nobody ever went to jail and nobody, you know, it's not just me. There are a lot of guys that were working in intelligence and the military who were having the same situation where they would find out things and go, hey, this is not, and they'd take it up the food chain and nobody wanted to know. And I got very, very frustrated with this. So I actually set up with Ben's NZ. The aim of Ben's NZ was to actually find people that, instead of us having a revolution where we just same repeat the same cycle, I wanted to find people that had maybe a little bit of the answer so that we could instead actually maybe launch a little bit of an evolution. And so Ben's NZ is my travel around New Zealand, basically talking to some very, very clever people around the countryside. Evelyn Gilbert's been one of them that you've had on the show quite regularly, who have got some of the ideas about how we can, A, build better communities, but also learn to empower ourselves so that we don't actually have to get sucked into this kind of this insanity that's going on at the moment. And basically, in the situation, what happens is we create something which then leads other people to come to what we're doing. Eventually, what's going to happen is that, you know, that 1% is going to turn around and say, actually, you know, we're missing out. We need to be part of what they're doing. Because the more you try and just, you know, ram your head, you're banging your head against a brick wall. So you're better off just going, you know, you can't negotiate with these guys, so just go off and do your own thing and create your own little power base.
Yeah, exactly. Look, if there's an evil agenda and it's screwing with you in a million ways every single day, then there's nothing to stop you from screwing them back in any way you want.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't have to do it using violence. I mean, we have people here.
It can be as simple as raising your kids right.
Yeah, actually, that is a big part of the situation, because most people turn around and say, I'll try and tie this in, I can. Most people say, well, what can I do about it? Well, what you can do about it is actually do some very decent things around your own house and then your own community, and that's the very, very beginning part of it. And what I actually find quite interesting is, you know, we look at all these big bad guys with investment banks at the top, but we've also got to look at the forces that actually make communities disempowered, and that's, you know, the big deal.
Thank you very much. Ben Vidgen, postmanproductions.org. His new book, Ben's NZ, is on the shelves as we speak, and as opposed to on the drawing board like most of his other work. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.